This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. One day, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin seem to be buddies. The next, angry rhetoric makes it sound like the Cold War all over again. Dramatic flip-flops make us wonder how much of the tension is driven by politics and how much by personalities. That is a question William Taubman has been investigating for five decades. He's a Sovietologist and a professor emeritus at Amherst College. Won the Pulitzer Prize in 2004 for his biography, Khrushchev, The Man and His Era. His upcoming book about Mikhail Gorbachev will be released this fall. William Taubman is speaking tonight at a ticketed event in Pinehurst, North Carolina, and joins me now for a preview of tonight's talk, What's Up with Russia? William Taubman, what a pleasure. Good to have
you. How are you?
I'm doing well. What is up with Russia?
Well, Russia is in a bad state in some ways and a good state in other ways. Putin managed to bring it back from what he describes as a miserable time in the 90s and from what he describes as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe in the 20th century, the collapse of the Soviet Union. So people are living better than they have for many years. But on the other hand, as a result of the sanctions imposed by the West and the fall in oil and gas prices, the standard of living is now going down after going up. And many people would like to demonstrate. Thousands, hundreds of thousands came out in 2011 and 2012, and Mr. Putin didn't like that. So he began arresting them and threatening them, and so they went back inside, many of them, to avoid being detained. So in that sense, Russia is an unhappier place than you might expect.
And so does that make it a more dangerous place for us in the United States in the sense that is it a nation that is becoming desperate?
It makes it more dangerous for us because Putin's formula is to build his legitimacy now through nationalism and annexation of Crimea and what seems, or at least what he and his media portray as a victorious war in Syria and their intervention in Ukraine. That is, until a few years ago, he seemed to be buying the loyalty of the Russian people by improving their living standards. But now he's buying it by appearing to be a victorious statesman and warrior. And that, of course, makes life more difficult for the people around him and for us.
Well, those are two threads that I think would be interesting to untangle, because what we saw in the immediate aftermath of the dismantlement of the Soviet Union was that nationalism certainly was an important factor in those countries in the former Soviet bloc and certainly former Soviet Union. That was the card successful politicians played. On the other hand, as you point out, Putin did make things better for a short period of time. Sort of why not pursue that, a more sustainable route of actually making people's lives better?
Well, the state of the Soviet economy depends on oil and gas. And when the prices went down, he was in trouble. That happened for Gorbachev, too. The prices went way down. And before that, under Brezhnev, they went way up. So the state of things in Soviet Union and now in Russia depends on the price of oil and gas.
Let's talk about personalities. You know, in your forthcoming book about Gorbachev, I had a chance to read just a little bit of it, and you'd go into some detail about the personal relationship between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev and the sense that they really grew, there was a bond of trust between them. Tell us a little bit more about that, because I want to talk about these other two personalities, Trump and Putin, and kind of what we can expect if we know anything about their relationship and what that might mean for us.
Well, Reagan and Gorbachev didn't expect much from each other. Reagan appeared to be an arch conservative on the warpath, talking about the evil empire that was the Soviet Union. Gorbachev expected bad things. But when they met, they hit it off. We call this personal chemistry, and it sounds like a cliche. But it really works when it happens. Of course, they had some substance to share. They both turned out to be nuclear abolitionists. Reagan, surprising everybody around him, wanted actually to eliminate nuclear weapons. And the people around him, by the way, didn't like that. And Gorbachev shared that view. But I discovered as I read the transcripts of their summit meetings, of which they had five, the first one at Geneva, then Reykjavik, then Washington, Moscow, New York, that they liked each other. And that made a big difference. It wasn't simply that they liked each other, but they shared many of the same characteristics. They resonated. Gorbachev and Reagan were both from small towns. They both grew up with a sense that I suppose one gets in small towns, that you can trust your neighbors. They were both optimistic. self-confident. It even goes to the point where one of the best descriptions that I know of Nancy Reagan, written by Francis Fitzgerald, fits Raisa Gorbachev perfectly. Yeah. And when you read the accounts of the summit, both by them, you read the transcripts, you read their memoirs, they read the accounts of others who were there, you can see them taking a liking to each other. And so although not much was accomplished of substance at Geneva, they both went away thinking there'd been a breakthrough. Mm. And as I was doing my research, I wondered to myself, well, what the hell is the breakthrough if it wasn't in negotiations? And it was that they came to trust each other.
An important point at a time that was really critical and very dangerous for us all. If you think about the Soviet Union at the time, really in decline, there's a certain calculus in game theory that if you think you're going to lose equilibrium, that's the time you become most dangerous, right? That's the time when there's at least a voice within the Kremlin that might be making a case, let's go for broke.
Well, Reagan, of course, was trying to intimidate Gorbachev through the Strategic Defense Initiative, otherwise known as Star Wars.
Right.
And Gorbachev had people around him who were telling him, you can match this, not by building your own strategic defense, but by building tons and tons of rockets and just flooding whatever Reagan puts up there. But Gorbachev didn't want to spend the money on that. And he recognized that that was a recipe for instability and even war by mistake. So he was looking for a way to cut back. And it turned out Reagan wanted to cut back, too.
So talk about the in the current environment, and I guess maybe a question I have before I talk about the relationship between Trump and Putin and what that means for us. I'd like to know essentially what the source of power for a man like Vladimir Putin is in contemporary Russia, where you really get your power, if it's not in the popular vote, sort of where are the tenets of power, tentacles of power?
Well, it's partly the popular vote, even when it's rigged or partly rigged. Hmm. That is, Putin has won big in the elections, partly because he has rigged some of them. His rating, as the Russians call it, is something like 80%. He drops to 70%. We know what Trump's is now. It's something like 36%.
Right.
So Putin is genuinely popular. Plus, Russia has reverted to its age-old pattern of authoritarianism in which the leader counts. His minions are afraid of him. They tell him what they think he wants to hear. He threatens them either implicitly or explicitly. And he has at his disposal the police, the secret police, the military. He's got many, many levers with which to maintain his power.
So that gets to the genealogy of that power as well. As you say, this goes back a long time, even to Tsarist Russia, the idea of this authoritarian rule, which is something that Russians have come to accept and expect.
The great exception to Russia's century-old pattern of authoritarian rule is Gorbachev, who, as he often has said, he said, if I wanted to remain in power and just sit there, I could have. But instead, he tries to democratize the country, and in the process, he releases forces that in the end overwhelm him.
Well, and that gets to what happens when you get into power and don't understand the culture in which you find yourself. Some could describe that as Donald Trump's current dilemma and situation, where an authoritarian a candidate or a president with authoritarian tendencies doesn't understand the power of longstanding bureaucracy and its many, many, many sources of power here.
Well,
in the
that, of course, was the theory behind the Constitution and the separation of powers, and I hope it's working.
What do you make of this tension? At times, you know, here the Russians are accused of meddling in our election and, in fact, favoring Donald Trump. They were pushing for him. And then we see all of these tensions between, occasionally tensions between Putin and Trump, the U.S. and Russia. Is there any way to get behind this and understand what's really going on?
Well, one thing you have to go back to is that when the Soviet Union collapsed at that time and for the next 10 years, the United States worked in various ways out in the open through agencies like USAID and others to help the Russians learn to practice democracy. We had people over there helping them to run campaigns and that sort of thing. But to a guy like Putin in the KGB at that time, and retaining that psychology, that looked to him like interference in their internal affairs. And although I can't prove it, I am absolutely certain that when Putin put his minions up to interfering in our election, he said to himself, it's no different. Yeah. They interfered in our elections. We're going to interfere in their elections.
Justification would be one thing, but rationale, what do you get from it? That's the other. And there's this argument that somehow Putin benefits by sheer disruption and chaos.
Well, it wasn't sheer disruption in the sense that he did not like Hillary Clinton. In fact, he hated her. He blames her. He blamed her in public for being the one who egged on those thousands, tens of thousands who demonstrated in 2011, 2012. I think that's more than political. We know from Putin's autobiography, the people who helped him put it together, journalists, interviewed his elementary school teacher. And she said, the one thing I remember about Volodya is he doesn't like it when people insult him. He wants to get revenge. So Putin takes things personally, and I think he took Hillary Clinton personally.
Well, again, that bodes ill to some extent. You have a president who doesn't shrink from launching insults and doesn't always take advice on this. You can imagine a war of insults between the two, and what might that mean for us?
Well, at the moment, or up until now, Trump has been very positive about Putin, as Putin has been about Trump. And I must say that as a Russia specialist all these years and somebody who watches the new Cold War closely, my thought was that this was not a bad thing, and that Trump might indeed be able to do a deal with Putin, which might be useful to both sides and the world, in the sense that I think the new Cold War is too nasty. The new Cold War is nastier than it needs to be. You know, we've gotten to the point where it's as if no senator or congressman in the United States can say the word Putin without prefacing it with murderer and thug. Putin is not a nice person. He's a bad person. But it doesn't help to conduct relations with somebody by prefacing their name with murderer and thug. And so to the extent that Trump wanted to make a deal, depending upon the nature of the deal, it might have been a good thing.
What about tell us more about this new Cold War and what it means? What are the stakes and what are the objectives? Are they any different than they were 20 years ago?
The new Cold War resembles the old Cold War in various ways, which one doesn't have to mention, you know, suspicion, armament, all the rest. It's different in a couple of ways. One, it's less global because Russia is now no longer a superpower. It's also less ideological. The communist ideology is gone, and Putin has substituted patriotism, religion, that sort of thing. But it's very nasty, and it could lead to, well, it's already led to the Russians mobilizing on the Baltic borders, the borders of the Baltic states. It's led to overflights coming very close to NATO areas. It's led to the United States reaffirming its guarantee of the safety and sovereignty of states like the Baltic states. You know, it puts us very close to a situation where a mistake could lead to a conflict, a war in Europe.
I wonder about that. I wonder if things are more dangerous. I've seen critiques that suggest that things are actually more dangerous today than they were during the height of the Cold War.
I'll give you two examples of how they're more dangerous. One is that in the old days, the frontier was the middle of Germany. Now it's on the border between the Baltics and Russia, hundreds of miles closer. Another, I thought myself that we were safer because we have fewer nuclear weapons, the result of arms control agreements between Gorbachev and Reagan and Bush. But in addition, it turns out that the development of the electronic age has possibly put us in a position where our electronic warning systems of nuclear attack could be hacked. Right. I don't know this myself, but I've been told this by people who are involved. And I was also told that if that happens, we could be confronted, or the Russians could be confronted with a warning, with a computer that says you're under attack and you've got to respond. You have 15 minutes to decide whether you're going to shoot off your rockets. And one other thing that I was told, and again, I don't know this, and you'd have to pursue this to find out whether it's true, but I was told that some of the Russian electronic experts in the military area who are of Muslim descent have disappeared. And there is talk among the experts that ISIS may be after them. Now, this could be a fantasy. It could be a nightmare. But it is a nightmare scenario in which ISIS somehow, instead of blowing up, you know, suicide bombers, tries to tamper with the early nuclear warning systems of either side.
Right. So you can either get a false signal to one side or simply disable the other side if I knew that I was about to launch an attack. Also, perhaps we're not as sensitive to the depth of a threat that Russia has a right to feel. When the Soviet Union fell, the Warsaw Pact was dissolved, but not NATO. And now NATO is on the very border, you know, all the NATO nations, which is to say all of Europe and the United States, arrayed against what is now Russia without the support
of the
Warsaw Pact.
That's one of the things I'm going to talk about tonight in Pinehurst. If you look at the way NATO has expanded, first Eastern Germany as part of reunification of Germany, then in 1997, Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. Then in 2002, Slovenia, Slovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, and the Baltic states. All of that was a tremendous provocation to the Russians. But the biggest provocation at all came in 2008 when NATO promised eventually to accept as members Ukraine and Georgia. And Putin doesn't even believe that Ukraine is a nation. He thinks it's really part of the original Russian entity that began in the Middle Ages. So when it looked for a while as if Ukraine, including Crimea, including the Sevastopol Black Sea base of the Russian fleet, was going to end up in NATO, this was intolerable.
And to put it in perspective, I mean, imagine if the Warsaw Pact were to expand and include Mexico and Canada. I mean, this is what the Russians are looking at. Right?
George Kennan, who was, of course, the fabled analyst of Russian-American relations, said very early on that this kind of expansion was going to produce a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. Namely, people are afraid of Russia, so they expand NATO, and then Russia acts as to make you afraid of them.
Right.
I understand the other case. Other side of the coin was that Poland and Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic and Hungary begged to be admitted to NATO, and they had become democratic states, and this was what their people and government wanted. So how can you say no because the Russians tell you not to?
It's a tough decision.
A tough decision.
If you maintain NATO at all, on the other hand, is there a need for NATO since the Warsaw Pact has been dissolved, the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc has disintegrated? Why maintain NATO?
Well, that was a decision made by the first Bush administration. Yeah. Gorbachev was urging them to, and he thought he had a promise from the Bush administration that they would first change NATO from a military to a political alliance. And then Gorbachev imagined that NATO would disappear along with the Warsaw Pact and be replaced by some new security architecture for Europe. But it didn't happen.
Give us briefly a sense of what's going on in Syria. We have obviously very different views about Assad and the Assad government, but that we do have a sort of a mutual enemy in ISIS.
Well, I don't know Syria myself, but I know the Russian attitude towards Syria. And I think the Russians viewed what happened in the Arab Spring as an extension of what they call the color revolutions that happened in Georgia and in Ukraine. And they look at it as the Americans maneuvering with their allies to produce regime change. And they didn't like it in Georgia. They didn't like it in Ukraine. They didn't like it in the Arab in Egypt. And they weren't going to allow it in Syria. And that's what they're preventing or trying to prevent.
Great stuff. I wish I had more time. William Taubman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Khrushchev, The Man and His Era. He is the Bertrand Snell Professor of Political Science Emeritus at Amherst College, and he's got a book coming out soon on Gorbachev, which we will talk to Gorbachev, His Life and Times. And when that comes out, we'll talk to you again. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
William's going to be speaking tonight at a ticketed event sponsored by in Pinehurst, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Also, coming up on Movies on the Radio, we want to know your best and worst remakes, things you love, things you hated, you know, Manchurian Candidate, Beauty and the Beast, Total Recall, et al. Let us know your picks. Email us at sot@wnc.org. Tweet us at #SOTMovie. There's more to come. Stay tuned.